Mark 9:14-9:29. Help My Unbelief was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 25, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Sort of spend our time in Mark 9, if you want to turn there, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, verse 14. Don't think of this as a Bible teaching this morning, because I don't think it's going to rise to that level. This is going to be some biblical musings. David will be beginning a series, continuing his series in Genesis starting next Sunday, and I want to begin a series in the late fall on 1 John, the epistle of 1 John, and then on into the Gospel of John. So we've got 1 week here to do something, and I can't make it a series, so I just want to insert some biblical musings here about something that I've been thinking about here recently. At the Summer Institute at Gutenberg College, I did some reading in Kierkegaard because we were going to have Kierkegaard as one of our assigned readings, and I found some stuff that really challenged me, challenged some of my thinking. He forced me to confront some issues that I really hadn't thought about in quite the same way. And that's what I want to explore a little bit, but I'm going to have to get at it by a bunch of random comments that hopefully triangulate to a point, we hope. But let me start then with Mark chapter 9. And I want to focus on one comment in this chapter, but let's take some time to develop the scene here and understand it, and then I want to focus in on the one comment that this man makes: I believe, help my unbelief. I want to talk about that. Starting with verse 14, when they came back to the disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. This is right after the account of the Transfiguration. John, James, and Jesus had gone up on the mount, and there had been this event, this vision of some kind, where Moses and Elijah appear, and Jesus appears visibly in a kind of glory, glorified state, and the voice comes out of heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." So that they've had that event. The rest of the disciples had remained behind, lower down the mountain. So Jesus, James, and John are coming back down the mountain, and they confront the remainder of the disciples arguing, it says, with the scribes. Now, I don't know what they were arguing about. That would be interesting, and I haven't even tried to speculate at this point, but something's going on. Immediately, when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed and began running up to greet him. The him here is Jesus. And he asked them, "What are you discussing with them?" And one of the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it slams him to the ground, and he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. I told your disciples to cast it out, and they could not do it." And he answered them and said, "O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me." This man comes out of the crowd, confronts Jesus, and says, "My son has this spirit," later he's going to be called an unclean spirit, "that causes all these symptoms." The symptoms sound a lot like epilepsy, which might lead some people to say, well, these naive first century country folk, they just didn't know about epilepsy. They attributed it to an unclean spirit, but really it was a medical condition. I think that's too easy to come to that conclusion. He not only has epileptic seizures of sorts, but he's also deaf and mute. And interestingly, in this very event, the boy has a seizure on cue at the appearance of Jesus. So there's all kinds of things about this event that make it implausible to me, you know, unless somebody's made all this stuff up. Assuming this is true, there's all kinds of stuff about this event that make the conclusion that this is an unclean spirit causing these symptoms rather than some medical condition a very rational conclusion to come to. I've mentioned this before, but I'll say it again. I think the problem that we have is we live in a time and a place where unclean spirits simply are not active in the world in the way they were in the first century. And I think that the Bible itself presents a picture as to why that's the case. Before the coming of Jesus, the world was in darkness. And one of the symptoms of that darkness was the level of the activity of the deceiver. The deceiver was active in the world to make plausible all kinds of polytheistic, spiritualistic worldviews that were contrary to the truth of the gospel and the truth of the God who really was there. So the unclean spirits, these demonic forces, the power of Satan to deceive the nations was at a level that we have never experienced and can't even really imagine. The light came into the world and dispelled the darkness. With the coming of Jesus, we enter into an age where the power of Satan to deceive was limited, was curtailed, was bounded to a significant degree. The day is going to come, if I read my prophecy correctly, which is a big if, but if I read my prophecy correctly, the day is going to come where Satan will be released from the abyss once again and will be sent out, will be released to go out and, as it puts it, deceive the nations once again. So the day may come where the kind of event that we're describing here, or the kind of phenomenon of this boy, becomes more commonplace again, where unclean spirits are far more active in the world than they are today. But we can't relate to it. So if all we've ever seen are ailments that have a physiological base, that are actual physical ailments, that's our only experience, then we read something like this and we immediately go, there must be some physical ailment going on here. But Luke, in particular, seems to recognize the difference between an ailment and an unclean spirit. He will describe people coming to Jesus to be healed of their infirmities and to have the unclean spirits cast out, and seemingly making a distinction between them. There are two kinds of realities and they're not the same thing. What we're dealing with here is actually an unclean spirit. When it's reported that his disciples could not cast it out, he responds, "O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me." Now, what is he responding to? I'm not sure. This is speculative on my part, but this is what makes the most sense to me. Both the attitude of the crowd and what he perceives to have been the attitude of the disciples is what he's responding to. Neither the disciples nor the crowd quite get it. And that is, of course the disciples don't have the power to cast out the demon. Jesus doesn't even have the power to cast out demons. Nobody has the power to cast out demons. This is not X-Men and superheroes. That's not the worldview that is the true worldview. In our superstitious mythological disposition that we have, our minds gravitate toward a worldview that sees Jesus the Messiah performing miracles as doing so as some kind of superhero. That's our automatic frame of reference. To really have an adequate belief, an adequate faith, a faith that is true, is to embrace an entirely different worldview. And that is a worldview that recognizes that we are all, in the end, creatures, but we all stand before a creator in whom we live and move and have our being, as Paul puts it. We live before a creator who scripts every moment of our lives. And as the scripture of our lives and as the scripture of the entirety of reality, every aspect of it, every detail of it, there is not a single thing that is impossible for the God who authors all things. How could there be? He's not just one of us, a bigger, more powerful creature, a bigger, more powerful being. He's not even a being. He's the author behind all being, above all being, beyond all being. He's far more significant than we imagine in that regard. If he were a being, then he would be limited by the nature of his being. But he's not a being. He's beyond being, if you will. If that sounds too metaphysical and spooky, then find some other way to think about it. But the point that I'm making is there cannot be any limitation on God. There cannot be anything impossible for him because he is not bounded in any way. He's not answerable to anything in reality. Not to physics, not to chemistry, not to metaphysics, the metaphysics of this world. Nothing limits him. Nothing prescribes anything that he could do. So when the crowd comes and asks the question or makes the comment, your disciples couldn't cast him out, I think Jesus recognizes that they're coming out of a faulty perspective. They're coming out of a faulty worldview with their observation. Yeah, duh, the disciples couldn't cast him out, but that's sort of not relevant, is it? The issue is not could the disciples cast the demon out. The issue is would the God of the universe act? Would he intervene? Would he do something to help here? That's the only issue. So he responds, "Oh, unbelieving generation." And I am inclined to think that he doesn't mean at this point this particular time in history, this particular generation that I'm dealing with. It's probably more, "Oh, unbelieving spawn," that is the human race. The human race, we're all infected by the same disease of having a proclivity to not get it, to not understand God, to not know who our Creator is and acknowledge his transcendence. So I think he's just sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know, it's gone. But I think he's just sort of being reflective about the tragedy of human blindness and human ignorance here. "Oh, unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me." They brought the boy to him. When he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion, and falling to the ground, he began rolling around and foaming at the mouth. And he asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. It has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible to him who believes." I want to come back to that and retranslate that slightly. "Immediately the boy's father cried out and said, 'I do believe, help my unbelief.' When Jesus saw that a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, 'You deaf and mute spirit, I command you, come out of him and do not enter him again.' After crying out and throwing him into terrible convulsions, it came out, and the boy became so much like a corpse that most of them said, 'He is dead.' But Jesus took him by the hand and raised him, and he got up. When he came into the house, his disciples began questioning him privately, 'Why could you not? Why could we not drive it out?' And he said to them, 'This kind cannot come out by anything but prayer.'" Again, I think the way this passage ends is consistent with what I was saying earlier about his comment about it being an unbelieving generation. We misunderstand what he's saying if we don't get out of our superstitious mode of thinking about this and into the true biblical worldview. It's not that prayer has some kind of power. There's nothing that drives me battier than the bumper sticker, "Prayer changes things." Because it's playing right into that pagan worldview that what we need are the right formulas, the right incantations, the right techniques, the right religious disciplines, the right religious techniques in order to bring the powers that be into under my control so that I can take the powers that be out there and direct them to solve my problems through my acquired skill at spirituality and religion and so on and so forth. That's the way these people are thinking at this time, and that's what Jesus is combating. The disciple says, why couldn't we cast him out? And I think Jesus, by answering, these things don't come out except by prayer, he's redirecting their thinking. You can't cast it out because you're a fool human being, that's why. It takes the Creator God of the universe to intervene and determine that this is no longer going to be true. It comes out by asking him to do it, not by you doing it. So it's not that he's not saying prayer is some kind of tool, spiritual tool in your hands that you can wield if you know how to wield it, some kind of spiritual lightsaber. What he's saying is God and only God can accomplish this kind of thing. If it's going to be accomplished at all, it happens by your asking him to intervene through what he calls prayer. Okay, when it says this kind, I think that's misleading because a lot of people read that as if, you know, there's 12 and a half different kinds of demons and you guys just happened on that species of demon that is kind of immune to being commanded in the name of Jesus to come out. You got to add prayer to it in order to do this. It doesn't have to be translated that or understood that way. I think when he says this kind, I think it's what in our idiom we would say this sort of thing. This sort of thing cannot come out by anything but prayer. And I think what he means is any unclean spirit. When you're confronting the reality of an unclean spirit harassing another human being, you as a human being are powerless to do anything about it. There's nothing you can do. Only the Creator God can intervene and put an end to it. So all you can do is ask him. Okay, I want to back up now to the and focus on this interchange between Jesus and the man in verses 23 and 24. The man has come to Jesus and says, if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. And Jesus picks up on the way in which he has framed the question. If you can, what exactly do you mean, if I can? Why couldn't I? Is implicit, I think, in his question. Let me retranslate this. Well, and then the question is, he says, all things are possible to him who believes. The question is, what does he mean by him who believes? Is the him who believes Jesus? All things are possible for Jesus if Jesus believes, and because he believes, all things are possible for Jesus? Or does he mean if you, the Father, believe, then all things are possible? What exactly is he saying here? I take it this way, to paraphrase it. And Jesus said to him, this, if you can, to the one who believes that I am who I in fact am, all things are possible for me. So he is saying, all things are possible for me, Jesus, being the Messiah. That's just a fact. All things are possible for me. And if you believed that I am who I say I am, you would get that. You would know that. You would understand that. I think that's what he means by this phrase. All things are possible for me to the one who believes that I am the Messiah that I am. So he's confronting this man with his own identity. The same thing that happens over and over and over again with the Gospels. Jesus performs the miracles as signs attesting to his status as the unique Son of God, the Messiah sent to be king of the eternal kingdom of God one day. All these things are intended to provoke us to ask the question, who is this man? And to finally answer it. This is the Son of God. So he's doing that with this man. If you knew who I was, if you believed who I was, then you would recognize that all things are possible for me. I'm not limited. Of course I can. of course I can cast out this demon. Because it's phrased the way that we do, and because we have a proclivity toward the kind of Superman, superhero, superstitious view of things, this reads, all things are possible to him who believes. It reads like a formula for, it reads like something coming out of the mouth of Yoda. You know, if you believe, if you use the force loop, you can levitate the spaceship out of the swamp. But you just have to believe with enough intensity. One of the problems is what this word believe means. We have this tendency to take believe to be an intensity of desire, an intensity of confidence, an intensity of optimism, or a combination of all those things. It's this almost liquid thing that flows through our veins, and if it surges through our veins with enough force, then it empowers us. I am a person of faith. And that we have a tendency, a proclivity to think in those terms. But faith is simply to have beliefs about reality. It's closer to the idea of knowledge and understanding than it is to anything like desire and optimism and confidence and so on. It's a question of the content of what we know. And my faith is either faulty, that is, inaccurate, false, distorted, a distortion of the truth, or it's strong, in which case it is accurate and on target. I know what reality looks like. I know reality the way it really is. That's what Jesus meant when he talks about the unbelief of this generation. It wasn't that they lacked a certain kind of intensity to their desire and longing and confidence and optimism. What they lacked was understanding. They didn't get it. They didn't know who God was, the God beyond all reality, the author of all being. They didn't think of him that way. They didn't believe things of him that conformed to that truth. And so their belief was lacking, was absent, was insufficient. So the question for the man is, do you know who I am? Do you understand who I am? Do you understand the role that I, Jesus, have? If you understood the role that I have, you wouldn't be phrasing your comment, your question, your appeal. If you can do anything about it, would you help us? I am the centerpiece of God's creation. I am Lord of Lords, King of Kings. I am the invisible image of the I am the visible image of the invisible God. All the power, all the authority, all the prerogatives of God Himself are focused in human form in me. If I can? Of course I can. Then the man says, immediately the boy's father, and most texts say with tears, cried out and said, I do believe. Help my unbelief. And I think what he means by that is, I do believe that you are who you are claiming that you are. I don't think it means I do believe that my son can be healed. I mean, that's what the whole phenomenon of faith healing wants us to believe, that I gain power over God in my life if I simply believe that God is going to do something. Then I got God in a bind, and now he has to heal me because I believe I'm going to be healed. Somehow I gain control over his will through my faith. That's not what he's saying here. He's not saying I believe that there's going to be a healing, therefore there is going to be a healing. He's responding to exactly what Jesus has said. If you believe that I was the Messiah, and he says, I do believe that. I do believe that you are this unique one sent from God. Help my unbelief. That's the part that I want to focus on here this morning, because I think this is what Kierkegaard challenged me to recognize. Kierkegaard, in his book Fear and Trembling, and I've recognized this for a long time, but I've never really quite grasped the significance of this. He describes, I think I've mentioned before, he describes the night of faith and the night of infinite resignation. And the night of faith is basically is the New Testament believer, is the person who has the faith that the New Testament is talking about. But he has a whole couple paragraphs talking about what a prodigy the Knight of Faith is, how rare such a person would be, that is, maybe even non-existent. Maybe there is no such thing in the world as someone who really believes. Well, my tendency was to just kind of dismiss that and say, well, okay. I mean, I'm a believer. You're probably a believer, Soren. I know some other people who are believers. Yeah, there's all kinds of disciples of Jesus who are real, legitimate, authentic disciples of Jesus in the world. I mean, what do you mean if there is one? Of course there are people who believe, who have faith. But as I read some other of his works, I began to see what he's saying. There's a difference between what faith is when it manifests itself in its ideal and what faith is as it manifests itself in our lives. There's this huge gap between the attitudes that I ought to have, the actions that I ought to take, the choices that I ought to make, the behaviors that I ought to engage in. There's a big difference between that and what someone who really, completely, totally, without qualification, without confusion, without compromise, believed. There's this huge gap. There's the ideal of faith, and then there's the faith as it actually manifests itself in our lives. Now, I've recognized before the distinction between the gap between who I am in my being and who I am as a believer. I've recognized that for a number of years now, that I am a sinner. I am an unworthy, corrupt, depraved God-hater at the core of my being. That's who I am. But God has given me a heart that hungers and thirsts after righteousness. He's given me a heart that acknowledges my own depravity, that sees the tragedy of my own depravity, that trusts God for salvation and so on, and that there's this gap between who I am in my being and the condition that God is producing in my heart, and that that's an important gap. I've recognized that. But Kierkegaard is suggesting that I go one step further and think a little bit further about this. And that is another gap, the gap between what God is doing in my heart and what the condition of my heart, the purity of my heart would be were it to be finished, were it to be complete, were it to be perfect, were it to be uncompromised, were it to not in any way be deficient. If my faith were not to be deficient in any way. And as I confronted that challenge, I realized there's all kinds of things in the Bible that suggest that he's right about that. Just think about your own life, and let's take a few things that Jesus teaches us, or that the Bible teaches us, maybe the apostles teach us, some things that they teach us, and compare what it would mean if we really believed what they were saying versus the way I experience and live my life. And the Bible tells us that the praise of other people in this world is fleeting, empty, irrelevant, and not worth pursuing, not worth concerning myself about. And yet, there are times in my life where I long for it and I crave it as if it were the most important thing in my life. Now, do I know, do I have faith, do I believe that the praise of other people in this world is fleeting and empty and not worth pursuing? Yeah, I do believe it. But I don't believe it enough. That is, I don't believe it enough in the sense that every response in every situation, in every encounter, acts as if that were true. I don't. That's just the fact and the reality of my life. I become seduced by a lie. I become seduced by a deception that there's some kind of fulfillment, some kind of satisfaction, some kind of substance that will come to me if I have the applause of other people. And so I go for it, and I want it, and I long for it, and I desire it. Only after I have been disappointed and God slaps me around a little bit and I look back and I realize, well, that wasn't worth it. And I'm reminded once again of what I have been taught, that the praise of other people is not worth it. The Bible teaches me that it is better to give than to receive. And yet, I grasp things and hold them to myself for dear life. I will not give. I will not give up. I will not sacrifice when something is important enough to me. Well, do I believe that it is better to give? Do I believe that I will be more myself and more fulfilled and more satisfied with my existence if I am a giver and not a taker? I do believe that. I do know that. I have been taught that, and I don't resist that notion. And yet there's this other thing in me that can be blinded by the lie that you must keep what you got and don't let go of it. The Bible has taught me that it is better to serve than to be served. And yet, I am ever so slow to serve other people. Is it because I don't believe it? Well, ultimately, yeah. I don't believe it enough. But I do believe it. I mean, I've been taught that. Jesus has made that clear to me. And I don't resist it. I don't resist the fact that it's true. I know he knows what he's talking about. But I don't always clearly have that in view when I make my choices and when I make my decisions. The Bible teaches, Jesus taught us that God cares for all of his creation generously and abundantly, including me. The birds of the field, the birds of the sky, the flowers of the field, and me. He cares for us generously and abundantly. I really don't have anything to worry about in terms of my ongoing existence and my care and my nourishment. God will take care of me. I have been taught that. I know that. And yet I worry and I'm anxious about whether I will have enough of what I think I need. Do I believe it? I do believe it, but I don't believe it enough. Not enough that it actually translates into attitudes and dispositions and emotional responses to things in the way that it ought to, in the way that it could, if I really fully believed the truth about that. The Bible teaches that I must turn the other cheek. Jesus taught us that. And yet I'm outraged at the least little insult or humiliation. Why? Because I don't really believe that it's wise to turn the other cheek. I do, but not enough. The Bible teaches that I do not need to be acknowledged and recognized for the good things that I do, for the righteous person that I am. And yet, I find myself annoyed when others receive praise and I don't. The Bible teaches that God is a God of mercy, who has asked us to emulate him and to forgive people when they have done evil to us. And yet I am slow to forgive, reluctant to forgive, almost resistant to forgive at times. I'm anxious for revenge in one form or another. They need to get it because of what they did to me. The Bible teaches that our yes should be yes and our no should be no. If we were knights of faith, if we were people of faith, you could count on my word absolutely. As much as it was physically possible for me to keep my word, I would keep my word without in any way unhesitatingly faithful to my promises. And yet, I am quick to lie or bend the truth or make empty promises in a second in order to avoid an uncomfortable situation. Oh, yeah. I'll do that. Oh no, that's not true. And I will go there in a second if I can avoid discomfort in my life. Do I not believe in the reality that Jesus is teaching me? I do, but not enough. The Bible teaches that I'm not to love the world nor the things in the world, and yet I've sunk my roots ever so deeply into this world. In so many ways. The Bible teaches that I should never turn away a brother in need, and yet I can't bring myself to loan my brother money because it's too risky. I might lose it. I'm taught that I ought to love my neighbor as myself, and yet I find myself constantly thoughtless, insensitive, and callous to other people. I ought to have my thoughts and desires pure, untainted by sexually immoral lusts and desires. And yet I find that the fantasies and mythologies generated by our perverse sex-crazed culture are fascinating. And we could go right on down the line, and without fail, I can see the contrast between what I would be if I truly, perfectly, completely, and only believed, and what in fact I am. What in fact is the character of my life. And there's this huge, huge gap. So the way Kierkegaard puts it at one point, and I couldn't find it again, but and I'm probably making this up, but never mind. At one point, I think he said, and this may just be my paraphrase, but he said, he described himself as barely Christian. I'm barely Christian. And I think I now know what he means, is that when I see the contrast between what ideal faith would and could and should look like and who in fact I am, I'm barely even in the game. Which raises, obviously, the important question is, am I in the game? What we don't like looking at it this way. I have resisted for years looking at it the way Kierkegaard is looking at it because it raises a very, very uncomfortable question, and that is, well, how do we know whether my faith is adequate enough to make me a child of God, destined for eternal life? How do I know if my faith rises to the level of saving faith then if it is so woefully short of what true and authentic faith would look like? How do I know then? It's a very uncomfortable question. And let me address that for a second, and then I'll open it up for your discussion. It seems to me that what the Bible teaches is we need to find our way in this life somewhere in between terror and insecurity on the one hand and presumption on the other hand. There are many passages we could go to where the Bible is telling us, don't be presumptuous. Don't presume on your status. Probably the one that's most significant of all is the passage in 1 Corinthians, 10, I think? Maybe it's, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there, where Paul says, I buffet my body and, help me, He's talking about using the imagery of an athlete in training, and then he ends that by saying, I'm in training, I'm working hard, I am doing the work of working out my salvation, I'm buffeting my body, lest after having preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. Well, if anyone short of Jesus in world history has a mature faith, I would think that the Apostle Paul would qualify. But even though he has a mature faith, he does not presume that his inheritance is secure such that it really doesn't make any difference what choice he makes in the next moment. It's that kind of presumption that the Bible warns us against. Now is the time when we are working. The day will come when we can rest. Eternity is described as an eternal rest in the book of Hebrews. We rest then. Now's the time to work. The Sabbath rest awaits us, but now is the time to be exerting ourselves. Well, what is it that we are exerting ourselves toward? We are exerting ourselves toward making sure, guarding ourselves, watching ourselves, staying awake, pinching ourselves to stay awake, to make sure that my mind and my heart is focused on the values of the kingdom of God, on the teaching of Jesus, on the truth as Jesus delivered it to me, and not be seduced by all the tempting lies and mythologies of the world. I can't relax in that battle. I can't rest yet. I must continue the fight. I must be on guard. I can never relax out of presumption. Well, I've made it. I'm okay now. I'm a child of God. I don't need to worry about whether or not my life manifests the right kind of faith or not. Surely if anyone has manifested the right kind of faith, I have. I'm in. That kind of presumption is deadly, is destructive, is what precedes the fall. On the other hand, the Bible is adamant about our security, our safety. We don't need to be terrified. In a passage I haven't completely figured out yet, Paul says, perfect love casts out fear because fear involves punishment. And if I'm understanding what he's saying there is, if I have a full grasp of what the implications of God's love for me are, there's no place for fear, no place for terror there. I don't need to be insecure. My salvation is not about me and my performance. My salvation is about that God, that transcendent God who more than is, his commitment to me. And if God is for me, Paul writes in Romans 8, who of any consequence is against me? What could possibly remove me from receiving the benefits of God's love for me if God has committed himself to love me? Nothing can take me out of his hands. There's no way. So there's no room for terror, because if I am authentically chosen of God and authentically a child of God, it's just a matter of time when God will finish the work that he's begun, and I will be taken into glory and given my inheritance and eternal life. I can relax in that fact, in that truth. So the place we need to live our lives is someplace between those two, someplace between presumption and the insecurity and terror over here. And the way Paul puts it in Philippians is, we are to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. And I think that's a way of describing the road that we're in. We work out our salvation with fear and trembling because on the one hand, we need to be on our guard. We need to be alert. We need to be awake. We need to be wary. The world is trying to seduce me away from the truth, and I dare not let it do that. And I need to fear the possibility that I be seduced away from the truth. That's a healthy and legitimate kind of fear that I must always live with in this world. But I'm not terrorized by that, because I recognize that it is God who is at work in me. It is God who is doing this, and nothing can thwart the purposes of God. So I don't go, my fear does not translate into terror, but neither does it translate into, neither does my my security translate into presumption. So my faith, a mature faith, it seems to me, can be confident but not presumptuous. It can involve a knowledge that I am in good standing with God. I think I really can know where I stand with God. But along with that knowledge is a corresponding knowledge of how vulnerable I am. If I do not take care, I could be seduced into abandoning my belief in what's true. I can be secure, but not altogether comfortable, in a sense. I can be assured of my standing, but never with the thought that I am the least bit worthy of it. That's the knife edge of true faith, faith in this world, I think. The fear and trembling that Paul is talking about, and I'll end with this, I think, is that my faith is never good enough. It is never what it ought to be. Therefore, I know that I need to take care to work at making it approximate more closely what it ought to be than it does right now. My faith is never so grounded and deeply embedded that I can assume that I am not vulnerable to being seduced by the world. That's the fear, that's the aspect of fear and trembling, I think, that Paul is talking about. I know that I am not what I ought to be, and I know that I am vulnerable, and therefore I am alert. My spiritual body is taut, waiting for the danger that lurks out there for me, and I don't take for granted that I'm safe against it. Okay, let me, just to leave you time some interact, let me stop there.
It seems to indicate that one could go that route when they're experiencing some big speed bump to overcome it in some way.
Could you explain the speed bump part?
Well, a difficulty like a stronghold or a place that one might be in bondage in a certain area.
Okay.
Like, say, someone has a propensity for pornography or, you know, other areas they just have a hard time getting over. And when I read this, it seems to me that a person could resort to prayer and fasting to help loose that stronghold.
Okay. And why do you say prayer and fasting? Do you have a King James version?
Because of this verse 29 in Mark.
Okay.
And I know there are other places in the Bible that sort of point, you know, even in the Old Testament where there's some difficulty and the people resort to prayer and fasting and then God hears their petition in that way. So he heals their land or restores what the locust ate,
okay,
and things like
good.
That.
So. All right, thank you. Well, some of you will have different translations. You'll notice "and fasting" is not in the text. It just says prayer. It doesn't say prayer and fasting. There's different philosophies for how one goes about deciding what the actual original Greek text was. And some of our modern translations are based on a Greek text according to one philosophy, and other, the King James and some of the older English translations were based on a different Greek text compiled by a different philosophy. So one of the questions that we face is, in the original Greek text, is the "and fasting" included in this verse? Because not all Greek manuscripts have that phrase. Some Greek manuscripts just end with anything but prayer, period, and they don't even have in the Greek text "and fasting." I don't subscribe to either of those philosophies in its entirety. I'm kind of eclectic in that regard. My decision, my judgment on this particular verse is that the "and fasting" does not belong in the original Greek text. I think that's got added, and it really is not a part of what Jesus said. And we can talk about why if you want later. I don't think he's saying that you need to enter into some kind of religious practice or religious discipline. Rather, when he says it cannot come out by anything but prayer, is simply his way of saying it can't come out in any other way than by asking God to intervene. Because God's the one that's going to have to do it. You can't do it. Now, the Old Testament is different, because you have in the Old Testament all kinds of expression of prayer, both prayer and fasting, these strictly expressions of piety, religious piety, that they entered into in this dance that they were doing with their God, and God responded to that and responded positively to that. But I say the Old Testament is different because what's happening in the Old Testament is they are working out their faith in the context of a covenant that God has made with them and the context of a religious culture that has been inspired or even commanded by that covenant. The Jews are supposed to be religious. They're supposed to be religious because it's a part of the covenant that he made with them. But religion, the value of religion and the import of their religion, I think, is largely symbolic. Fasting is not valuable, is not effective, is not commanded in the Old Testament because there's something about fasting that makes it effective. Fasting is simply a symbol, I think, of either mourning or contrition or both. The mourning that comes out of the contrition. God, we are unworthy. It's a way of wearing on my body. Sackcloth and ashes is another thing. You fast and you put on sackcloth and ashes as a way of communicating to God, I am unworthy of you. I'm bringing myself low in order to have my outward appearance and condition correspond to what I know is the truth about who I am morally and spiritually before you. Well, the real work that's being done in fasting and in sackcloth and ashes, the real work that's being done is the existential thing. It's the decision on my part to acknowledge the truth about my existence. if you and I sitting here well-fed and well-clothed before God, in my heart, bring myself low and come to realize that I am unworthy of God and that anything I get is only by His mercy, then that's the work being done. That's what we need to do. That's where we need to be. That's the religion that we need to practice. If we have done that, you and I as Gentiles don't need to go the step further of engaging in fasting or using sackcloth and ashes. We don't. We don't have to. It's not prescribed for us. It's not a part of a covenant that we're in. It's not a part of a religious culture that I need to be a part of. I don't have to do it. Could I do it if I wanted to? Absolutely. If I want to make it my own homespun religious expression before God, then as long as it's a reflection of a reality in my heart, then it's a meaningful thing that I could do. But there's no obligation for me to do that. Would acknowledgement of my need for God to intervene and my own unworthiness be the stance that I should take as I approach God, asking Him to free me from my slavery to some sin? Sure. Absolutely. That's exactly how I should approach God. Are there any guarantees that God is going to deliver me? I don't think so. I don't think there's any guarantees. Whatever the thorn in Paul's flesh was, he appealed 3 times that it be removed, and all 3 times God said, nope, ain't going to do it. Roger.
I have a question. I can hear my Reformed fellow believers saying something like, you just said that we should live as if we're not safe. And they would say something like, if I'm a believer, then I am safe. That somehow the sanctification that's going on in my heart is an indication that God is at work in my life and that I can rest in that and be assured of that. Would you like to maybe synthesize those two things or somehow respond to that?
Well, they're right. If I am a believer, then my destiny is secure. Now, if I could only know if for sure I was a believer. If I'm of the elect, the destiny of the elect is absolutely guaranteed. That's true. Am I or am I not of the elect? Ah, that's another question. And so the important personal question is my own standing, my own personal individual standing. Am I or am I not? And that's where I think Reformed theology at times caters to our desire for presumption. And there are some forms that Reformed theology takes where it is the very embodiment of presumption, and they're just wrong. They're going contrary to so much of what the New Testament teaches. No, I cannot presume that I'm of the elect. Tomorrow could always prove me wrong in that presumption, because I could be seduced by the things of this world and begin to not believe the truth that my Lord taught me at all, and not really have any authentic orientation toward the truth as Jesus teaches it, and follow lies and myths and deceptions. And tomorrow could always show me that that's who I am. That's why I need to go in tomorrow with the fear and trembling that says, I am of the elect to the extent that I continue acting like somebody who's elect. Therefore, I must never relax in my pursuit of walking in a manner worthy of the calling that I've received. I can't relax in that task. I need to be diligent. Now, Reformed theology tends to emphasize God, the centrality of God, the power of God, and all that. And to that extent, absolutely, that's exactly what the Bible teaches. That if, like I said, if God is for us, who is against us? That if God is for us, there is no threat in the world, in the universe, in the cosmos, in all of reality. There is no threat to God accomplishing the purpose of saving me, His elect. And there's a tremendous security that comes from knowing that. I mean, that's not an unimportant thing to know. And we must acknowledge that and emphasize that on the one hand. On the other hand, I live in here. And the question is, who am I? What is my standing? Am I or am I not of the elect? And that issue is something I need to face with fear and trembling.
I had a question I wanted to ask, but I want to make you say more about what you were just saying. Because there's a part of what Roger said that you dismissed that I'm not sure whether you meant to dismiss it or not. Because earlier...
It was such a long question, I didn't...
Okay. Well, when we stand to talk about an issue like this, I mean, you kind of stand, you turn and you look in this direction. I'm looking at the presumption side of it and make these statements. And I turn around and look at the terror side of it and I make these statements. Ultimately, we want to find some place where both of those things can be reconciled, where I kind of know where I'm standing in the middle. That's the part I want to talk about. Because you said earlier that basically you know where you stand before God. I can know where I stand before God. That part of it didn't come out in what you just said to Roger, because it seems to me, I mean, I would agree with that statement that Roger made, that the Reformed guy would say about my sanctification being some sort of indication that God is doing something in me. It seems to me that idea that I might tomorrow turn away from God is a thought that I need to take seriously that would keep me from presumption. But I have more confidence than just if I happen to be elect, I will be saved. I do have the whole history of my life that suggests to me that in fact my faith has been tested, not with the stamp of approval that I've got my ticket where I can go to God and say, look, see, I've got my guarantee. But I've actually got something to say, I don't think I am going to turn away from God in the end. Now, I need to keep awake and, in fact, not do that in the days that are before me. But I know something about what God has done. Would you agree with that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Well said.
Okay, so, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what happens is because of our proclivity toward presumption, we can take something like, well, I have evidence of my sanctification, so there.
Yeah.
And that's the part I'm saying, well, it's not quite that easy. So there, yeah, the so there can lead me to that confidence that God is on my side, God is for me. And I can know that God is for me based on what Romans 5 calls docime, you know, the attestedness of the authenticity of God's work in me. I see it. I see the evidence of God's work at me. I can rationally conclude that God is for me, and I can rest in the fact that God is for me, and then the security of the elect becomes a relevant truth for me. And I think that's perfectly valid. But not the basis for cocky presumption. I mean, not even Paul had that, and that's what we need to avoid.
Right. I changed my mind. I'm not going to ask my question.
I hope this is just a quick question, but in regards to our dialogue answer to my question a little bit ago, it makes me wonder what place the Old Testament principles have in our walk with the Lord. If I mean, when I read the Old Testament, I'm inspired by Abraham's faith and things they do, and I understand that it's not by ritual or my performance. But I'm wondering, by the way you answered, I'm thinking, then why bother reading the Old Testament? It sounds like we're not under any obligation to follow what they did.
Well, there's at least three things. This is off the top of my head, so don't hold me to this number. Maybe there's four or five. But there's at least three things going on in the Old Testament. You've got God, the creator of all reality, interacting with human beings and confronting human beings and asking them to know him, love him, submit to him. That's the same for us as it was for them. There's no difference. So there's much we can learn by Abraham's encounter with God, by Moses' encounter with God, by the prophet's encounter with God, right on down the line. We're in the same ballgame with them in that regard. That in the final analysis, my whole existence is about coming to terms with my Creator and being rightly related to my Creator. So to the extent that that's what's going on in the Old Testament, it's very relevant to us. The other part of what's going on in the Old Testament is a little different, because whether we like it or not, whether we understand it or not, God has decided that one of the things he's going to do in world history is do this unique thing with a unique people, what's called a peculiar people. God is going to have a peculiar relationship with a peculiar people over the course of history. And it's a long-standing relationship. It's a relationship that I don't think is over. I think it spans thousands and thousands of years. And one of the stories that's being played out in that is the faithfulness of God to his promises. Even if the promise was made 10,000 years earlier, 10,000 years later, he has not forgotten that he made that promise, and he's ultimately going to keep it. And so it's going to dramatize the depth of the faithfulness of God, his little interaction with this people, the Jews. Well, in that, most of the Old Testament is preoccupied with that peculiar part of the picture. And we need to recognize that in order to rightly understand it. And part of that picture is a covenant that God made with them when he came to Israel and said, okay, I made a promise to Abraham. I'm going to get on with that promise now. I promised I would be your God and you would be my people. Let's start. And let's go to this mountain and we'll cut a deal. We'll make a contract here and we'll begin this relationship of I being your God and you being my people. Well, God kept the his being their God part, but they didn't keep the there being his people part. They never have to this day. But I believe they will one day. The day is coming when they will keep that promise. And that will be the fulfillment of a whole bunch of prophecies. What was that covenant all about? That covenant said that the requirements that God made on the people of Israel were, I want you to, in this covenant, is I'm going to ask you to be authentically morally good, because I'm good and I want you to be good. So there's a moral vision for what it means to be a good human being that is encoded in the law, in the covenant, as one aspect of the covenant. As another aspect of it, he said, I want you to be a society that is a holy society, a distinctively different way of conducting yourselves as a culture and as a people, to get living together. And so he wanted them to be a holy nation. That involved things like stoning people for certain crimes, actually literally purging the nation of their evil. Is that because that's how every society throughout all time should be operating? No, I don't think so. Because every society throughout all time has not been called to that unique relationship of doing an experiment in holiness, of actually creating a holy society. We certainly are not in America. As Marvin Alasky once put it in a speech I heard, America is an experiment in freedom. Ancient Israel was an experiment in holiness. I think he's exactly right about that. We're seeing our experiment in freedom is a failed experiment. The experiment of holiness is going to be a successful experiment in the future sometime. And then as part of that holiness that he's calling them to, he asked them to dress funny, eat funny, talk funny, and be funny in all kinds of different ways. Just be weird, peculiar people. What part of that is relevant to us? The only thing that's really directly relevant to us is that moral vision for what it means to be a good person. Because even though that's a part of the covenant that God made with Israel, it is nevertheless the embodiment of a moral vision that applies to every human being, Jew and Gentile alike, throughout all time and culture. So we can study the law with a great deal of profit to simply be instructed in what does it mean to be a godly, good human being. And there's much profit to be gained there. And then the third thing that it's valuable for is in seeing this interaction, this relationship between God and his people, we can get to know God. We come to learn all kinds of things about the depth of his mercy, the depth of his compassion, his faithfulness, his loyalty to his word, his justice, his wrath, his power. I mean, we just learn all kinds of things about God. And in the final analysis, one of the essential features of what it means to be a godly human being is somebody who seeks to know God, and has come to know God, and who loves God. And the Old Testament is a tremendous resource for coming to know God. And there's probably other things that I've forgotten, but there's all kind. In other words, there's a lot of reasons that we should read our Old Testament. In fact, we don't read it nearly enough.
This part's not a question, but in the New Testament itself, it says to read it too, that they're good examples for our faith, which is interesting.
Exactly. We've kept you long, but thank you.